This first compound is C4H10O, which means what degree of unsaturation do we have? Zero. And then there are four peaks, 3.337, integration of three, that's a singlet, 3.336, which is a triplet integrating to two, 1.59, which is a triplet of quartets, which, remember, that means you have two different neighbors, and that integrates to two as well. And then we have 0.93, which is a triplet that integrates to three. So let's start out with degree of unsaturation. Since the degree of unsaturation is equal to zero, the compound must be either an alcohol or an ether, as those are the only two functional groups that have an oxygen, have a single oxygen, and also don't have any degrees of unsaturation. So no aldehydes, no ketones. Also, this is not going to be a cyclic ether. There's no ring because there's no degree of unsaturation. So let's think of the different ways we could put a single oxygen in with four carbons. Because it turns out there's not that many structures. We could have an isopropyl group, for example, on one end, and a methyl group on the other. We could have something more symmetric. Good old diethyl ether. We could have something like this. But to skip ahead, and I'll write this one down in a moment, and I should have started this one with this one first. We can't have an alcohol. Why not? There's nothing that integrates to one. So if you look at the integrations, 3, 2, 2, 3, we only have one oxygen. This might not be such a simple trick if I had more than one oxygen, because then I'd have to worry about whether I might have two alcohols. But since I only have one oxygen, which could be one alcohol, that would give me an integration of one somewhere. But I don't have that. And so that's why I'm looking at these example ethers. So I apologize. I'll write that integration approach in just a moment. But knowing that it has to be an ether, I think this is pretty much the only three possibilities it could be, isn't it? Is there any way we could move anything around to generate a different molecule without making an alcohol? Doesn't look like it. So, let's do the same trick that we've done for several problems now and just count unique signals. And for any of these experiments that we're doing, any of these problems that we're doing, we're always going to assume that we're dealing with achiral solvents. So we don't have to worry about enantiotopic protons at all. And in fact, this quarter, I'll tell you in advance. I'll carefully choose examples where you don't have to worry about diastereotopic protons either, because we need some more practice before we build up to that. So, having said that, how many unique types of hydrogens are there on the first compound? On the left side, I'm sorry. Three, right? We have the methyl group. We have the position where the alcohol is attached. And then we have the two equivalent methyl groups. Well, we can stop right there even without counting the peaks, because if we have two equivalent methyl groups, we have something that integrates to six. So we know it can't be that. But
more to the way that I'm working this problem, we'll say there's three absorbances. Then the next compound, does that give us the right number of absorbances? How many types of hydrogens do we have here? Only two, because it's symmetric. Realize, by the way, both today and the previous lectures where I'm writing in the different types of hydrogens, just so we don't clutter the diagram so much, I'm not writing every hydrogen in. So just be careful when you're studying this that you recognize that. I'm just trying to show types of hydrogens. So here we only have two absorbances. So that must mean that this last one is going to end up being the correct answer. So yes, Dante, you were correct. The methyl group is its own hydrogen. The position next to the oxygen is different. Two positions away is different. Three positions away is also unique. So this has a total of four absorbances. And as we'll see going over the other methods, this is going to turn out to be the correct answer. So now, since I've shown you this, let me put in what should have been number one, realization of integration. Maybe I could characterize it as part of one, really. Since there is only one oxygen in the compound, it is either an ether or a mono alcohol. If it was an alcohol, it must have a peak that integrates to one. It doesn't have it, which means it must be an ether. And then we could solve the problem looking at integration, because we do have a peak that integrates to 3. And because of that, it can't be diethyl ether, because that would have an integration of 6. And then, again, this first compound, two methyl groups that are the same, yet again, also would generate an integration of 6. Only the last compound would give us an integration of 3 without having an integration of 6. Now, what about chemical shift? How does chemical shift information help us? Well, if we look at your table, there's a few absorbances that would matter. If you have an alcohol, and you're looking at that alcohol absorbance, your book claims that that can show up between 4.5 and 9. Now, practical experience, I don't remember ever seeing an example with an alcohol that has an absorbance at such a high chemical shift. And in fact, I've seen compounds that have significantly lower chemical shift. So an alcohol, if you know you have an alcohol because of process of elimination, then knowing this chemical shift might be a backup piece of information to help you solve the structure. Otherwise, sometimes since it is such a broad range, and again, I'm saying it might be even broader than what's indicated here, that might not be too helpful. But if we look at the range for a hydrogen next to where an alcohol is, on the carbon where it's attached, that has a tighter range of 3.4 to 4. Let's just wonder for a moment, why might an alcohol have a broad range of chemical shifts? In fact, I think this is something we discussed last quarter. What would happen if we put some D2O into a sample that has an alcohol that we were trying to scan? Does anybody remember that discussion? There was one day I know that we talked about cyclohexane, because we were talking about chemical equivalency. The fact that at low temperatures, cyclohexane slows down its motion enough that you can actually distinguish between axial and equatorial protons. And I think in that same lecture, we talked about this trick. Alcohols, even though they're not very much so, they're acidic. They have pKa values of 16 to 18. And they do undergo dissociation. It's an equilibrium. It doesn't like to be dissociated permanently, but those protons can hop on and off very rapidly. So what can happen is that at room temperature, if you put D2O into a sample, deuterium will exchange with the hydrogens that you're trying to scan for. And it'll actually make the peak disappear effectively. So if you're trying to confirm whether or not you have an alcohol peak, you can put a drop of D2O. Watch for the peak that disappears. That's the alcohol peak. Does that sound familiar? Or maybe I didn't do that with this section. Okay, so that's an aside. Let me write that down after I fill in this chemical shift information. I thought of that, though, because since the chemical shift for an alcohol itself isn't always that useful, that trick from D2O is. But now we need one more piece of information, that a hydrogen two positions from an alcohol has a chemical shift about 1.2. So let me write down this thing about proton exchange. So alcohols undergo rapid proton exchange in solution, which means they can temporarily dissociate and then acquire a proton again. There's actually one more effect that, anticipating problems we're going to do probably next week, I might as well mention now. Because of this rapid exchange that's going on, it can occur rapidly enough that the proton, even when it's there, even if you don't add D2O, so you do get an integration, because of that rapid exchange, it doesn't do any splitting. So even if you have a hydrogen like this, that technically is only one position away from a carbon that has hydrogen neighbors on it, those neighbors are not going to split the alcohol proton, which can make it a problem confusing, which is why that's why I didn't actually give you an alcohol to start with, because that can really complicate or confuse, because you're expecting to see some splitting that's not there. Now, of course, if I was being really nice, I could say at a far below room temperature scan, here's what a spectrum looks like. And then again, when you slow things down, there's not as much exchange going on, and so you would see splitting then. So this proton exchange causes alcohol hydrogens. To not participate in splitting. And then splitting will reappear again if the solution is cooled sufficiently so that proton exchange stops. And now let me write down that note about deuterium. If D2O, and a fairly significant quantity of D2O, because you want to have the possibility of flooding an alcohol and turning it into a deuterium. If D2O is added to an NMR sample of an alcohol, the peak for the alcohol hydrogen effectively disappears. Since, if deuterium replaces hydrogen, it will not be scanned, since it is a different nucleus and would appear at an entirely different frequency. So now finally getting back to the chemical shift aspect of things. We've already identified up above it's not an alcohol. So if we look at the rest of the information, we've got hydrogens next to an oxygen, which, let me fill in one more critical piece of information. That the range for an alcohol and ether, as far as a hydrogen next to those functional groups, they're virtually indistinguishable ranges. So in other words, attaching an alkyl group to an oxygen only has a minimal effect on whatever neighbors might be next to that functional group. If we've already identified that we don't have an alcohol, then we have two different peaks that have a chemical shift of 3.4. We only have one oxygen. And so the only way we can have one oxygen but have two peaks that have that chemical shift value is, yet again, if we have an ether. So since the compound has two peaks that have an integration of roughly 3.4. The compound must be an ether, since there is only one oxygen and therefore only one way to generate two peaks with that chemical shift. Now, there's one last approach we could take, which is to look at the splitting. Because a singlet that integrates to 3 usually indicates a methyl group with blocked splitting. Which there's a couple of different ways to block splitting. We could have a carbon that has no hydrogens attached to it, which it's possible to come up with a structure like that here. But, and all of these pieces of information, of course, are kind of conflated together. If we again look at the fact that we have an oxygen there, putting an oxygen right next to a methyl group, well, that oxygen wouldn't have any neighbors as long as it's an ether. That would therefore explain why we'd have a methyl group with that chemical shift that is a singlet that, since the methyl group integrates to 3. And so it's a reasonable guess to make. But now, and this approach I'm about to take may be the one that you end up using more once you're used to some of these tricks. Because let's try to take just the splitting information and see from that if we can build the structure of a compound. We'll then use chemical shift to verify whether we made a logical structure. We'll verify that both integrations and splittings match. But now this is the style that in the future more of these problems are going to start to look like. So let me refer back to the peaks that we have. We have a singlet, we have a triplet, we have a triplet of quartets, and we have a triplet that integrates to 3. Now, didn't we have another problem just the other day that was a triplet that integrates to 3? What does a triplet integrating to 3 mean that we have? If we integrate to 3, what does that likely mean that we have? A methyl group? And if it has a triplet, then what does that mean about the environment of that methyl group? It's only going to have 2 neighbors, right? So if I start with a triplet that integrates to 3, then here are those 3 hydrogens, and then here's the triplet aspect of it. That it only has 2 neighbors. Now we have 2 peaks that integrate to 2. One of them is a triplet, one of them is a triplet of quartets. Which peak must correspond to the blue protons then? Oh, you can't. Oh, the colors are bad here. So these are purple, these are blue. So the methyl group is purple, this methylene is blue. So which of these 2 peaks, again, a triplet or a triplet of quartets, would be compatible with the 2 hydrogens? Why? We can have another neighbor here, so that's one aspect of it. But we have to have a quartet because there are 3 neighbors to the blue protons. So in fact, now that we know it's a triplet of quartets. And the quartet is caused by the methyl neighbor. Well, we know it's a triplet as well. What does the triplet mean? That on the other side, we only have two hydrogen neighbors. Which, there's only one other peak that integrates to two. Well, if it's only a triplet, then what does that mean about its neighbors? It has to be oxygen, because if you put a carbon there, that carbon's going to have hydrogens on it. That would cause the green protons to be split. Well, they are split, but only by the methylene group, the blue protons that we'd already established. So the fact that we've now crawled to the end of a chain, the fact that we're now no longer being split, that means there must be an oxygen here. So if I do like I did the other day and color code the spectral information, it'll end up looking like this. Oop. Ooh, dear. No. Wrong color. Oh, darn it. Ah! Sorry. The middle position here, these are the green hydrogens. And it's only a copying wrong for my own notes. Only two integration. How many of you got the problem? Well, Dante did. Oh, a few others, too. And did you... What would you say was the most useful piece of information? Like, what was your approach? Like, did anybody use any of these different methods that I just presented? Integration, okay. Splitting? Degree of unsaturation. Okay, so you, different ones have used different methods to get to the right answer, though it doesn't really matter which ones you use. But we'll just keep on doing some more practice. How many? Yes. Move it up. How many of you have done any NMR practice problems at home at this point?
Maybe I, by Thursday, should find some specific ones in the book to give you to do over the weekend so we can cover them on Tuesday, so you have a reasonable expectation of what you're going to have to do on the lab quiz. Sound readable? Okay. Let me show you one more problem. We'll do this quickly. Let me just ask, though, what is the reflux time for lab 7? I know I didn't tell you to do the pre-lab, but I was hoping that you all did anyways. Half an hour. Okay, so as long as I give you half an hour, we're okay. So we'll just kind of rush through this next example, and then we'll go straight to the lab. The lab that you're doing today, if you didn't do the pre-lab, that's all right for this time, but we're doing a Friedel Crafts acylation. Since we've already covered acylation, let me just go ahead and talk about this now since I'm paused from NMR. We've already talked about acylation in lecture. This is a slightly different kind of acylation. We'll go over the mechanism on Thursday. One thing I just want to make sure of is we're using aluminum trichloride, correct? All right. Aluminum trichloride is a really noxious solid because if you think the structure of aluminum trichloride, it's electron deficient, so it's really reactive with water. So even if you just open the bottle of the solid up, it starts reacting with water. Enough so that if you take a piece of pH paper and you were to wave it over the mouth of that bottle, the pH paper would turn pink because of the amount of hydrochloric acid that's being generated. So if you do it quickly, it's not such a problem. But it probably says in the directions about measuring out really, really quickly. Does it also recommend moving a balance into a fume hood?
Yeah.
It does. So we may end up using just the top loaders because those we can't remove are these. Okay, so we can, if we carefully do so, we can move one of these into the fume hood. But in other words, do not just walk around with that solid. Solids tend to be very deceptive in terms of safety because you think, oh, it's a solid, it's not going to do anything. Well, sodium metal is a solid, but it's rather reactive as well. So just treat the aluminum trichloride carefully, because what will end up happening if you are not careful, if you're just not paying attention and walking around with it uncovered, you're just going to be breathing in hydrochloric acid, which I think we would probably agree that's not such a smart move. Then what is the other main reagents that you're using? So xylene, which form again? Metaxylene, and then what was the other reagent? Maleic anhydride. So this is why I want to do the mechanism another day, because an anhydride, even though it's not an acyl halide, because it's got an oxygen attached to carbonyl, it has the same ability to react with aluminum as an acyl halide would. Now, anhydrides in some senses aren't as bad as acyl halides. They are one step lower in terms of reactivity, but anhydride means without water. So it's a compound that was formed by heating up, removing water from it. So it, again, would be something that would readily react with water. So in this case, though, the product is not as noxious, but it's still a really reactive chemical. And so this one you still wouldn't want to get on you or breathe in. So slightly more hazardous chemicals today, which is why I'm making the point of talking about them individually. Please, 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 I'm going to implode today if I see that aluminum trichloride bottle left open at any point. So if you're measuring out and you know the person behind you is right about to grab it, that's okay. It has to be open to get the chemicals out. But if it's just left open so it totally decomposes so the other sections can't do their labs, I'm going to be a little bit irritated, particularly since this is the second quarter of OChem. And there really shouldn't be any excuse for doing that anymore. I only say that because in both all three sections, I've noticed of different days, some bottles still being left without caps open. Since it's so infrequent, I haven't beat you all up about it, but can't do it with these compounds today. Same thing with the anhydride. Even though the results might not be as immediately harmful, you're still going to cause it all to totally decompose if you just let it sit there to absorb and react with water. Now, the procedure is, this is pretty much another shake-and-bake procedure, isn't it? Add everything together, reflux it or heat it, and then you have a series of separations or washes? afterwards? Separations only? Okay. If you just get the half hour of heating in and stirring, even if you can't do anything afterwards, your product should be fine because once the Friedel Crafts reaction occurs, what happens to the product? What happens to the reactivity of the product after an acylation? Compared to its starting point. So we have xylene. Is xylene an activator or a deactivator? Now we covered this section last week. We covered the types of orthopara activators versus orthopara deactivators versus meta deactivators, correct? We made those different columns. And in the first column we had alcohols, ethers, reverse esters, aniline, and didn't we also have alkyl groups? Yes. So remember that alkyl groups, even though it's just hyperconjugation, they are activators because they effectively, through hyperconjugation, provide electron density. So the metaxylene, that's going to be an activator. It's going to be slightly more reactive than benzene is. But once you do the reaction, it's an acylation. You put an acyl group on, which means you put a carbonyl on, which means you deactivate the molecule. Now, maybe in theory, once you cool it down, some side product might be generated, but it is a much, much slower reaction with that acyl group. And so that's why I'm saying it is likely perfectly fine for you just to leave your reactions as is if you don't get to the point where you can work them up. Now, I hadn't read this again for this year, but does it have you at some point put ice into the solution or the solution poured onto ice? I'm sorry? Pour it onto ice? Okay, that's very standard traditional way to work up Friedel Crafts acylation. I did a bunch of Friedel Crafts acylations in grad school, which, oh gosh, I'm thinking, predicting this. Do not worry about your color of solution. Friedel Crafts reactions can turn practically every color at some point in the reaction. So some of you are red versus orange versus brown versus yellow versus even kind of a greenish tint. All of it's normal and all of it's random. I don't remember ever having reproducible color results because these different salts that get formed, they can have slightly different colors to them. The aluminum salts that end up forming as byproducts. So don't worry at all about what color solution turns, except it is going to turn some nasty color. I can tell you from practical experience, the dangers of adding water to the Lewis acid. It's kind of like the old high school saying that you probably heard. Acid goes into water, water doesn't go into acid. Have you all ever heard that saying? A to W, not W to A? No. Oh, gosh. Okay, so why wouldn't you pour a bunch of water into a concentrated acid? Oh, this is just practical safety. I'm surprised no one ever, myself included, I guess, never said this. What happens when you mix water with acid? It dilutes the acid, correct? But there's an immense amount of interaction with strong acids, at least, and water. Think of HCl. HCl dissociates the way it does because it gets so favorably surrounded with water. So if you throw water into a concentrated acid, there's usually a large amount of heat released. Well, if you have a large amount of heat in just a little bit of water, that means you splatter. And so if you take a concentrated acid, just pour some drops of water on it, that can splatter out and get on you. And so that's why you never add water to acid. You pour acid into water, so the water helps disperse the heat as that heat of solution is evolved. Now, how did I get into that? Oh, yes. So this aluminum trichloride is a Lewis acid. So if, as one of my poor co-workers back in grad school did, take a liter-sized version of this reaction and pour water in it to quench it, hours later, after the stuff was still dripping off of the ceilings, we realized that was a bad move. Because there was so much heat, and it was in this thing that had a neck to it, so just a chemical rocket that we generated there. So you should add your Friedel Crafts reaction to ice. I was going to tell you to do that if your procedure didn't. because that is the correct way to do it, I can tell you from experience. Were there any other important safety notes that were made? I'm sure it must have mentioned the aluminum trichloride in the procedure about handling it. And did it say anything in particular about the anhydride? Because anhydrides are reactive, but it's not quite the same hazard as we have with the aluminum trichloride. Then that's the reaction you'll start for today, but now let me finish off with this last NMR problem, and then you all can just jump straight into lab, and we'll talk more about workup and the mechanism on Thursday. Yes?
What is a gas trap?
A gas trap. We don't need that. The reason we need the gas trap normally is because we're going to generate HCl. As the reaction occurs, or particularly once you quench the reaction, there's a lot of HCl that's generated. We're only able to get away with it because we have the fumes that aren't going to do effectively the same purpose. We could be a bit kinder to the system by using gas traps if we were doing a large-scale reaction. We certainly would do that. But given that even handling bottles of HCl in the fume hoods would also generate practically the same amount of HCl vapor anyways, that's why we're going to ignore it for this. So good thing you mentioned that. Ignore the gas trap component. The last bit of NMR for today. To start talking about alkenes. And alkenes have a feature of their spectra that we normally don't discuss with other functional groups. And it's not that other functional groups don't have this behavior, and what I'm referring to is splitting, but not just the fact there is splitting, but how much splitting. In other words, the splitting constants. For just plain hydrogen-hydrogen splitting, there is some splitting constant there, but generally we don't refer to it because normally it doesn't provide any extra information. All the problems we've worked so far, have we even thought of coupling constants at all? No, we've just used the splitting information as is. But with alkenes, the situation's a little different because there's three types of hydrogen-hydrogen interactions that potentially could occur on an alkene. So one of those interactions is a cis interaction, if you happen to have a double bond that has two hydrogens that are cis to each other. I've used this terminal double bond as an example because it has all three of the forms of interactions that are possible. A cis double bond ends up generating a coupling constant in the range of 12 to 18 hertz. Now, it's been just long enough since I've brought a class through this, that I'm going to have to go back my own self and re-study why is it that we use hertz now instead of ppm. So allow me to do that review, but let me just give you this information because at least we can use that to solve problems. Another interaction is trans. Wait, am I flipping these around? One moment. I think I just reversed these in my head. Yes, I did. I apologize. It is... yes. 6 through 14 for the cis, and then it is the 12 through 18 for the trans. But there's one more interaction that we never really talked about before, because before we were just naming double bonds. We weren't talking about the structure of double bonds.
there is this geminal interaction that occurs. Realize that the two hydrogens are different from each other, because one is closer to the top hydrogen, one is further from it. So automatically, since they're locked in that position, since it's a double bond, they're distinct hydrogens from each other. Since they're distinct hydrogens from each other, they split each other. And that geminal splitting has a splitting constant of between 0 and 3 hertz. How could that be used in a problem? Well, let's start with a simple one. C8H8. Now, this is an unusual peak. You haven't seen one like this before. And that M stands for multiplet. Multiplet, we use that designation if the splitting pattern is so complicated that we can't determine it, or if it doesn't matter and it's really complicated. Notice that we have this integration of 5. And look at the chemical shift range. With the chemical shift range, that integration and the degree of unsaturation chemical shift range in the integration, what kind of compound is this? Well, what is the degree of unsaturation? 4? Count again. 5, isn't it? Because 8 times 2 is 16, plus 2 is 18, minus 8 is 10, divided by 2 is 5. So 5 degrees of unsaturation. We have a chemical shift in the 7 range. Yes, benzene, which has a degree of unsaturation of 4 by itself, would show up in that range. If I had an integration of 5 with benzene, what does that mean? I have a monosubstituted benzene ring. If I have a degree of unsaturated of 5, and I have 8 atoms in a monosubstituted benzene ring, that means the compound is styrene. I don't actually have to continue. The fact I wrote this much up, I know the compound is styrene. But let's investigate further. Because there's 3 other peaks that appear. Yes?
Is it
Have I flipped around which way I'm doing it?
Yeah. Oh, no.
Traditionally, it's splitting then integration. In the book, it's switched? It doesn't really matter, per se. I'll go back and look at my research papers, because I hadn't looked at them so long. Maybe I've gotten the habit of reversing. But I'll look up what we did. All right, so we have a doublet of doublets that integrates the one that has 2 splitting constants. And in fact, we have 3 peaks in that situation. Slightly different chemical shifts, slightly different combination of coupling constants. So, based on the degree of unsaturation and chemical shift, it's likely the compound contains benzene. An integration of 5 suggests the compound is a monosubstituted benzene. And then again, given the limited number of atoms, if I use up six atoms, and I know that there's only one substituent, the other two carbons have to go on there. I know I have one more degree of unsaturation, and so that's how I can jump straight to styrene. But now let's try to match the different hydrogens on styrene to the spectral information. Now, because wherever I got this info from did not distinguish between the different types of benzene hydrogens. Notice these are not equivalent, not at all. That's why we end up with a multiplet, and that's why we have a range for chemical shift. But it's not unusual for benzene compounds, because this is such a frequent result. Any monosubstituted benzene potentially could have this kind of complication. So it's not unusual to report benzene in this way. So that's the only reason I'm writing all these hydrogens with the same color, because they correspond just to one absorbance. Now we do have the three other hydrogens, the one that is right next to the benzene ring, and then the two that are terminal. Which one is which? Well, we know from process of elimination which one is the hydrogen closest to the benzene ring. Because the one closest to the benzene ring can have a cis interaction and a trans interaction, but it can't have a geminal interaction. And if we look at the three different peaks, notice that there are two of them that have a splitting coupling constant of 2. That's right in the range of where a geminal proton would show up. And so those two with the coupling constant of 2 are the geminal hydrogens. The one that is not does not have a coupling constant of 2 is not the geminal, which means it is the one right next to the benzene ring. Now, how do we tell from the other two? Well, one has a splitting constant of 7, one has a splitting constant of 12. Turns out it's the trans that has larger chemical, or not chemical shift, larger coupling constant range, and so the coupling constant of 12 corresponds to trans, and the one at 7 corresponds to cis. Cis then would have to be the one that I've circled in green, and trans would be the one that I've circled in red. Now let me leave you with a problem to work on. In fact, let me give you two to work on for Thursday. These will be slightly juicier problems than we've done before. So one, I'll say that again, slightly juicier, since this one only has 6 absorbances. So C6H12, 5.45, that's a double of triplets that integrates to 1 with a coupling constant of 14. Another peak at 5.42, that is a doublet of quartets with an integration of 1 and again a coupling constant of 14. 1.95, that's a doublet of triplets integrating to 2. 1.643, that is a doublet integrating to 3. 1.360, that is a triplet of quartets integrating to 2. And lastly, 0.885, which is a triplet integrating to 3. That is one problem. And then here's the problem that showed up on the lab quiz 1 year. But that also admittedly was a year where we did a lot of NMR development. Yes. Did I? Oh, I'm sorry. I was looking at that wrong. Yes. I looked over, saw the sys, saw that was on the same position as where I put the green, but it's pointing the wrong place. So yes, sys is the bottom one. Trans is the top one. Now back to this. As I was saying, this problem was on the lab quiz 1 year, but it was a nasty one. So not that it's impossible that you'd get one this tricky, but might save it for next quarter. So chemical shift 6.342. That is a doublet integrating to 1 with a coupling constant of 6.2. 4.644, that is a doublet of triplets integrating 1 with a coupling constant of 6.2. 3.957, that is a triplet integrating to 2. 1.984, that is a doublet of triplets integrating to 2. And then 1.846, which is a triplet of triplets integrating to 2. So these will be the ones we cover for Thursday. Given the small amount of time we have left now, let's go ahead and just jump straight into lab. Yes. Yes. Well, people are still copying that, so just flip the dots.